the San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 26, Episode 4, Spillover, Animal Infections, and the Next Human Pandemic. Talking with author David Quammen. Hi, David.
Hello, Jim. Good to be with you today.
Our guest today is David Quammen, an author and a journalist. His 18 books include Breathless, The Tangled Tree, Spillover, The Song of the Dodo, and most recently, Heartbeat of the Wild. In recent decades, he's focused his writing on science, history of science, and the relationship of humans to landscape and biological diversity. His work has appeared in many magazines, such as The New Yorker, National Geographic, Harper's, Esquire, and The Atlantic, among many others. He's been honored with an Academy Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and he's a three-time recipient of the National Magazine Award. He joins us from his home in Bozeman, Montana. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you much, Jim. Nice to talk with you.
Same here. David, what drew you to writing about science?
Well, I was always interested in the natural world and always interested in writing from about the age of 10, 11, 12, those two things. And I began my writing career as a fiction writer. I published my first novel back in 1970 when I was 22, just out of college. And then after graduate school, I moved to Montana to get away from ivy-covered walls. I'd been to some very nice, good universities, but I was a little up to the chin with that.
Uh-huh.
And here was the natural world waiting me in Montana, and I got interested again in that. I discovered that it was very hard to make a living as a novelist, even though I had been fortunate enough to publish that first book early. So for about 13 years, I paid my dues between book one and book two, and during that time, I studied some zoology, I started reading history of science, I became very interested in Darwin, among other figures, very interested in evolutionary biology. And then I finally started turning myself into a nonfiction magazine writer focused on natural history and then more and more on ecology and evolutionary biology, not just natural history, but the science of wild creatures and wild places. And I gravitated in that direction and I've stayed with that side of the literary world ever since.
And what better place to do that than Montana? You're right there in the Rockies at the foot of Yellowstone, Glacier National Park. You have it all there. So not surprising that you would have taken that route.
Right. I found myself suddenly surrounded by mountains and forests and big critters, wonderful big critters like the grizzly bear, and spending time in the backcountry, doing a lot of backcountry skiing and hiking. And so it was the right place to pay attention to the natural world and how it works.
Well, David, the emergence of strange new diseases is frightening, and it seems to be getting worse. Ebola, SARS, AIDS, to mention but a few, all originated in animals and crossed over to humans. What is spillover?
Spillover is the event when a disease-causing microbe passes from its non-human host into its human host, or into a new human host, and takes hold. For instance, viruses. Viruses need cellular creatures as hosts. They are not cells. They need to live inside animals, plants, bacteria. And the viruses that have potential to infect humans live in other animals. So those are known as their reservoir hosts or their natural hosts. Every virus that appears suddenly in humans has come from an animal, another animal of some sort. And when that virus spills from its non-human host into its first human victim, that's the moment that scientists call spillover.
Mm-hmm. And the technical biological term is zoonosis. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right. That's right. Zoonosis is an animal infection transmissible to humans. So when that strange virus comes spilling out of a bat or a monkey or a rodent or some other animal and gets into humans, and if it takes hold and causes disease, then that disease is known as a zoonosis, mm-hmm. a zoonotic disease, having come originally from non-human animals. And most of our infectious diseases, in the strict sense, are zoonotic diseases. Some of them are old diseases that have been passing from animals into humans for centuries or millennia. Some of them are new diseases or newly recognized diseases like Ebola or SARS or some of the others that I write about in the book Still Over.
Did I read correctly that some 60% of the diseases that we as humans are susceptible to that we have were originally spillovers, zoonosis? Is that correct?
That's a conservative estimate, Jim. Hmm. Yeah, 60%. Yeah, and I, as I mentioned, in the strict sense, 60 to 70% of our infectious diseases have come within recent times from detectable avenues in wild animals. But humans, we're a relatively young species, 200,000, 300,000 years old. Everything comes from somewhere. So even our older diseases like measles, like bubonic plague, they have come originally from wild animals. And in some cases, like measles, they have developed into uniquely human diseases, but with an ancestral form that originally came from a wild animal.
That's fascinating. Now, you mentioned at the outset bats. Many of us, I in particular, have a fear of bats. I don't know why. I've very rarely encountered bats, but I just have this fear of bats. The fact that something that looks like a mouse with wings and sharp little teeth and what have you is something that has always sort of stood out in my memory as something to avoid. And doing my research for this show, one of the data points that really surprised me was that bats represent 25% of all the mammals on the planet. So if you put together all the mammals on the planet, starting at the higher end of the chain, us going through the four-legged and the two-legged and all mammals on this earth, 25% of all mammals are bats. Is that correct?
Well, that's true in terms of number of species, not in terms of abundance of individuals. Mm-hmm. So roughly one quarter of all species of mammal on planet Earth are bats, species of bats. It's an extraordinarily diverse order of mammals, something like 1,400 species of bats, extraordinarily diverse. And quite a large number of the zoonotic viruses that spill over into humans have their reservoir hosts in bats. So people sometimes demonize bats. It's important not to demonize bats. I can understand a little bit of fear of bats. I have a little sort of instinctive fear of spiders, irrational, but I'm a recovering arachnophobe. Bats are wonderful creatures. Spiders, of course, are wonderful creatures too. But bats are wonderful, amazing, highly adapted, extraordinary creatures. But they do carry a lot of viruses, and they have been implicated is probably the wrong word. They have been identified as the reservoir hosts of quite a number of the viruses that get into humans and cause trouble. Rabies, most famously, but also Nipah virus from Malaysia and Bangladesh, Hendra virus in Australia, Marburg virus in Central Africa, possibly Ebola virus, although that has not yet been confirmed. The original SARS virus in southern China from 2003 and others come to us from bats. And so people ask the question, why? And I spend pages and pages on that in the book Spillover, probing the question of why bats. But one of the most important reasons is simply that they have such a great diversity, 1,400 different species. Mm. So it might seem as though they're disproportionately represented as reservoir hosts of these viruses, but they are disproportionately represented in the diversity of mammal species.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book, Spillover, which was originally published in 2012, before our most recent pandemic, originally published in 2012, and the book opens with the story of a virus in Australia, the Hendra virus. Tell us about that, and tell us about the role that bats played in spreading that virus.
Yes, this is a textbook case of zoonotic disease spilling over from animals into humans, although most people have never heard of it. It hasn't affected a large number of people, but it has killed a large percentage of those it has infected. It appeared for the first known time in humans back in 1994, when there was an outbreak of a horrible, bloody, convulsion-causing affliction in racehorses at a stables, a racehorse stable in the suburb of Hendra, which is at the edge of the city of Brisbane. Mm-hmm. Hendra is full of racecourses and stables and racing people. And in this one particular stable, suddenly horses got very sick. They were frothing at the mouth. Bloody foam was coming out of their nostrils. They were convulsing. They were hurting themselves. They were falling down. They were dying. Three men worked to try and save them, and that was the stable owner, stable foreman, and a veterinarian. And about 12 horses died in the course of a couple of days. Mm. The stable foreman got very sick himself and went into the hospital. The stable owner, the stable foreman got sick and went home. The stable owner died in the hospital, and that got everybody's attention. And the veterinarian didn't get sick. He was lucky, or he was cautious, or whatever. And he became my source when I went out to Brisbane, to Hendra, to gather information about this wonderful veterinarian named Peter Reed. Scientists react to a new virus in humans, and this was identified as a new virus, not anything that had been seen in humans before. Eventually got the name Hendra virus after the suburb. Mm-hmm. And then scientists started working on the mystery of where did this virus come from. And they eventually found it in giant fruit bats, a couple different species of giant fruit bats native to that part of Australia. And these fruit bats had lost their wild habitat. The forests had been cut down over great areas of that part of Australia. Mm-hmm. And the bats had started coming to fruit trees in towns. And there was one particular fruit tree, a fig tree, mm-hmm. that was in a pasture where one of these horses had been put out to graze. And that particular was a mare, and it was a blazing hot field, and it mostly had no shade. This one fruit tree gave her relief because it offered shade, and she would go under that fruit tree and graze, eat the grass, and bats were drawn to that fruit tree for the figs. They defecated, they urinated, they dropped fruit pulp, they fell on the grass. This mare had picked it up. Mm. She got sick. She was brought back to the stables. She infected the others, and it spread from bat to horse to human. Has had over the years about a 50% case fatality rate when it gets into humans.
Shocking. But of course, a horse, the amplification of that Hendra virus in a horse, a huge mammal, that obviously the size of the amplifier played a role, did it not?
It did. And I call horses amplifier hosts in the book when I tell this story. Now, if you're a horse, you're not from the horse's perspective, you're not an amplifier host, right. You're a victim, you're an ultimate host.
Sure.
But if you're a human, then they have served as the amplifier because horses seem to be more susceptible to this virus and they suffer more exposure to the droppings of giant fruit bats than humans do. So this has recurred a number of times in Australia that horses get sick with this virus. They pick it up from bats, and then humans take care of the horses, and humans get sick. And I interviewed one veterinarian, a young woman who had a horrible case of it herself. She survived. She told me about it. I just tell her story in the book. There was another fellow, a husband of a veterinarian. He helped his wife take care of some horses. He got sick, seemed to recover, and then a year later relapsed and died from the virus.
Let's move on to National Geographic. Over the years, you've written many articles for National Geographic, and you had one assignment in particular in West Africa. including the country of Gabon and one or two other countries. Tell us about that assignment and how that assignment led to even more scientific research into spillover in the case of Ebola and beyond.
I assume you're talking about the project that we call the Mega Transect, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, National Geographic called me up one day in the winter of 1999 and said, I had never worked for them, and they said, we've got this big project. This fellow is going to walk 2,000 miles through the last remaining really pristine forests of Central Africa on a zigzag path, staying as much as possible away from human impacts, away from villages, away from roads, away from railroads. And he's going to survey the biological diversity to give when the inevitable happens, the inevitable perturbation is. And so I ended up saying yes to the request from this editor. Would I be the writer on this project and do a series of stories working with a photographer who was a friend of mine already, a legendary, I'm using that word, it seems like loosely, but these two guys really, really deserve it. A great photographer named Nick Nichols was going to be the photographer on the story. I was going to be the writer. And we shadowed this fellow, Mike Fay, for weeks and weeks as he did this 2,000-mile mega transect survey hike from the northeastern corner of the Republic of Congo to the Atlantic Ocean. He walked for 456 days. Mm. We only did sections of that with him. I walked with him four segments for a total of about 53 days. Bushwhacking through the forest, crossing blackwater streams and swamps, and sleeping on the ground, and we were all dressed in sandals and river shorts because you couldn't stay dry, and you certainly couldn't clean and dry mm-hmm. long pants or socks in that sort of an environment. So I discovered quickly that the way to do this was to adopt Mike Fay's method, which was river sandals and shorts because skin is ultimately easier to clean and dry than any sort of a tropical material. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of my relationship with National Geographic. It was a great experience. Arduous, a little bit scary occasionally, uncomfortable, but just a fabulous experience. Mm-hmm. And those three pieces that I wrote are at the beginning of the book that you mentioned, my most recent one, The Heartbeat of the Wild.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Ebola, which I think which was something that you encountered and on the first stage of your transect.
Yeah, this is how I got into a scientist named Carl Johnson, who had actually led the first response expedition to control the first known Ebola outbreak in Congo in 1976. I happened to meet him. And then in 1999 and 2000, I was doing this assignment with Mike Fay for Geographic. And at one point, we walked for 10 days, I walked through a particular forest area called Minkebi Forest in northeastern Gabon that was famous in the medical literature because there had been an outbreak of Ebola virus in a village on the fringe of this forest block. Something like 30 people had gotten infected and 20-some people had died. That had been in 1996, just a few years before we got there. And when we got there, not to that village, but to the forest block itself, we knew that the Ebola virus was there somewhere in that forest because that's how the village had gotten infected. They had gotten infected because someone had gone out, a group of boys had gone out hunting and they for meat, and they had brought back the carcass of a chimpanzee, and people butchered and ate the chimpanzee, and it turned out the chimpanzee had not been killed by the boys, but had been found dead and scavenged, and it had died of Ebola virus. So the people who touched and partook of that chimpanzee carcass got infected with Ebola. So we knew it was there somewhere in the forest and in a reservoir host, not a chimpanzee, because the reservoir host is an animal that has adapted to carrying the virus. Chimpanzees die of the virus, so they couldn't be the reservoir host. So we walked for 10 days through this forest, knowing that somewhere in a bat, perhaps, maybe a rodent, maybe a monkey, maybe a spider or a tick, this Ebola virus was living.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a spooky experience.
Oh, yeah.
We noticed that there were a lot of forest elephant in this forest block, as there should be. It was beautiful habitat. It was also beautiful habitat for gorillas, but there were no gorillas. For 10 days, we saw no sign of gorilla, no gorilla poop, no gorilla tracks, no gorilla nests. And that was starkly notable because it was great gorilla habitat. And so we had to conclude just inferentially that probably the reason that this forest block was empty of gorillas is because Ebola had killed them all.
Hmm. And at that point, were you able to, or has science been able to isolate and identify, is it a bat? Is it a rodent that carries the Ebola virus, or we still don't know?
We still don't know, because the gold standard of proof for identifying the reservoir host of a virus is to be able to find not just antibodies against that virus in the blood of that particular animal, but to be able to isolate, culture in the laboratory, live virus, reproductive virus, not just fragments of viral RNA, not just antibodies, but live virus. And although that has been done for Marburg virus, it has been found in bats. For Hendra virus, that virus has been cultured from bats. Nipah virus, yes, it's been cultured from bats. Ebola virus, no. It has never been cultured. Live virus has never been extracted from a bat. So although bats are the leading suspects, we can't say for sure that they're the reservoir hosts.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't then and can't still today.
Now, Ebola transmission of the Ebola virus from, in this case, contaminated chimpanzee meat to people, because they actually ate the meat. It sounds as though that transmission of the virus requires that level of sort of deep contact. Am I right in understanding that?
Yes. Ebola, as terrible a virus it is, as virulent a virus it is, as scary a virus as it is not a threat to the human population around the world, let's say, in anything like the way our COVID-19 virus, SARS-CoV-2, mm-hmm. has been, the way other respiratory viruses are. Ebola is not, as far as we know, as far as anyone has ever detected, a virus that can transmit through the air. It's not a respiratory virus. It's a virus that's transmitted through bodily fluids. It's transmitted in blood. It's transmitted in diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
It's transmitted potentially, I think, in saliva. I'm not sure I remember that correctly. But anyway, bodily fluids, and in particular, blood and diarrhea, because it causes people, and vomit, of course,
mm-hmm.
because it causes people to become sick in all those ways. Sometimes, but not always, there's a lot of bleeding. Usually, there's a lot of vomiting and diarrhea. And you have, as in the case of the very first outbreak of Ebola in 1976 at Yambuku Mission in northeastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, you have people who don't know what they're dealing with, have no warning, and they're cleaning up after the people that they're taking care mm-hmm. of. There were nursing sisters at Yambuku Mission who were dealing with these people who came in sick with this new disease that they thought might have been malaria, might have been some sort of a shigellosis, an enteric, a gut disease. And so these poor nurses were taking care of people, and they were, wiping up these bloody, emissions, probably with rags from the mission floor, with mm-hmm. their cracked, wounded hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got sick as well. A virus that passes in bodily fluids and does not float through the air, fortunately for humanity.
Now, later in the book, you also cover HIV/AIDS. And to the extent that you talked about the transmission by blood, bodily fluids, the HIV virus seems to have that in common with Ebola. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, yeah. HIV, as we well know, is not a respiratory virus. It's a virus that passes in bodily fluids. It can be passed, you know, the ways that we know, but it can be passed through sexual contact. It can be passed through needle injection. It can be passed through transfusion back in the days when people were not screening blood as they are now for HIV. And as I describe in the book Spillover, I've got a long section, about a 100-page chapter on the ecological origins of the AIDS pandemic of HIV-1 group M, the pandemic strain of AIDS. And it's a very different story from what most people think they know. It's a virus that's been in the human population since the early 20th century, 1908, give or take a margin of error. Of course, we didn't discover it until about 1981. I write about the first cases, the first alarm bells ringing from cases in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York in 1980, 1981. But by that time, the virus had been passing quietly from human to human for decades, for a lifetime. And it was the work in the early 2000s of a couple of scientific teams, one led by Beatrice Hahn at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, one led by Michael Warraby at the University of Arizona, who documented with strong molecular evidence that this virus had its origin in a single chimpanzee in the southeastern corner of the country Cameroon back around 1908, give or take a margin of error. And then it passed probably again through bodily fluids resulting from the trapping and butchering of a chimpanzee for food, and a hunter perhaps having a cut on his hand or on her hand, getting into the first human and then moving slowly from southeastern Cameroon down the river system to the big cities of the colonial Congo, Brazzaville, and what then was Leopoldville, mm-hmm. now is the city of Kinshasa, and from there to the world.
Mm-hmm. David, a question. How can science state with such certainty that a chimpanzee in southwest Cameroon, a single chimpanzee, was responsible for the transmission of the first HIV virus to a human? Could you tell us how that statement could be made with certainty?
Yes, I'll give you the, you know, the thumbnail version of that. It's sure. pretty complicated, as I describe in the book, but it's molecular phylogenetics is the fancy answer. The chimpanzees of southeastern Cameroon, like many chimpanzee populations across Central Africa, carry a simian virus. It's known as simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV. It's a close relative in terms of genome similarity to the HIV-1 group M virus. You can sequence the genome of this simian immunodeficiency virus in chimps. You can sequence the genome of HIV-1 group M as it has infected people and diversified all over the planet over the last, you know, particularly over the last 50 years. And you can find that there is the closest match, a very, very close match between the genome of simian immunodeficiency virus chimp in southeastern Cameroon and the entire diversification of HIV-1 group M in humans. That diversification of HIV-1 group M, the pandemic strain, is a very, very florid little branch on the family tree of simian immunodeficiency virus coming out of a node right there in the southeastern corner of Cameroon.
Absolutely fascinating. What fantastic detective work. Scientific detective work. Let's move on to SARS, because over the years we've heard about, of course, we've actually had it here in the United States, SARS, we've had avian flu. Tell us about SARS, and because a couple of chapters in the book you focus on that. Tell us about the development of SARS, the identification of the virus.
Right. Well, of course, Jim, it's what we probably now should call SARS-1, as distinct from the COVID-19 virus, which is of which the formal name is SARS-CoV-2. So what originally was known as was named SARS, as sudden acute respiratory syndrome virus, emerged in southern China in late 2002, early 2003, and started giving people horrible respiratory crises and killing some people in the Pearl River Delta of southeastern China and then the city of Hong Kong. And then it spread from the city of Hong Kong from air travel to a number of other cities, to Beijing, to Singapore, to Bangkok, and to Toronto, and started killing people in those places. And it caused a terrible scare around the world for people who were paying attention, because it was both a respiratory virus, highly transmissible from human to human, and it had a high case fatality rate. It was killing one person in 10, eventually infected about 8,000 people and killed 800. And then it was stopped. It was controlled by fast expert science and rigorous public health measures, good healthcare systems in those cities. As I recall, Hanoi was another of the cities that it spread to. And places such as, you know, Beijing, Toronto, Singapore, Hanoi, that had strong healthcare systems. And it was stopped. It was controlled. It was contained at 8,000 cases. And it was, of course, a coronavirus. It was the first of the, not the first coronavirus that ever infected humans, but the first killer coronavirus that we became aware of. And it was one of the things that made scientists so alert to the fact that coronaviruses were potentially very dangerous to humans, that they're carried by a lot of wild animals, including bats, and that they can spill over into humans. So that when I published Spillover back in 2012, I channeled the warnings of these scientists about what might the next big pandemic look like. And what they told me and what I printed was that it would be a virus, probably a single-strand RNA virus, a particular kind of group of families of viruses, that it would spill over from a wild animal, possibly a bat, and what sort of a virus, possibly an influenza or a coronavirus, possibly in a market situation where people are coming in contact with wild animals. All of that was in Spillover when I published it, not because I was prescient, but because these scientists knew their stuff and they could calculate what the likelihoods were.
David, a simplistic question. SARS, said the total number of fatalities numbered 8,000. One would have been too many, but 8,000 died.
No, cases, 8,000 cases.
Oh, excuse
and 800
me.
Fatalities.
Okay.
One in 10.
Even more to the point, 8,000 cases, 800 fatalities, one in 10. COVID. And we're not going to talk about COVID here because that's a whole other program. But COVID, yeah. How come SARS was so quickly apprehended and shut down and stopped? Whereas, what was the difference between the world's reaction, healthcare reaction to SARS, which seems to have been very successful, and COVID, which was not at all successful, certainly in stemming the growth of it globally?
Yeah. Well, first, Jim, I'll say that I laughed nervously when you mentioned COVID, because it's such a difficult situation.
Yes.
It's a difficult topic even to talk about. And it has caused such incredible death and misery around the world. One of the things that made the SARS-2 virus different from and much more dangerous than the SARS-1 virus is that it is transmissible. And from the beginning, it was transmissible from people who were showing no symptoms. With the case of SARS-1, the virus was not transmitting from human to human while during the early stage of infection, when people still felt okay, when they were going to work, when they were riding the subway.
I see.
They were carrying the virus, and it was beginning to spread, to multiply, to gather in them, but they weren't coughing it out onto other people. They were still healthy, and they weren't breathing it out onto other people while they still felt good. Whereas, and the scientists said, well, at the time, one thing that could have made this particular virus nightmarish was if there had been asymptomatic transmission, if there had been silent transmission from people who were infected but not yet showing symptoms. They knew that that's what could have made that first SARS virus much more dangerous. And then we had the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2, and that's one of the fateful characteristics that it had. From the very beginning, it was transmissible from asymptomatic infected people.
Well, David, thank you for that explanation. I appreciate that. Take a moment and tell us about the Nipah virus in Malaysia.
Oh, Nipah is another devastatingly lethal, but not very widespread virus. It was recognized first in Malaysia in 1998, my memory serves, and it was a febrile disease that was causing people to have crises of high temperatures and some other symptoms. And it was suspected first to be a disease called Japanese encephalitis caused by a virus carried by mosquitoes. And then scientists noticed, wait a minute, this Japanese encephalitis usually infects children because they don't protect themselves enough from mosquitoes. And this disease is not infecting children. It's infecting mostly ethnic Chinese people involved in raising pigs or in the pork industry. What could that mean? And the disease detectives went in and they discovered that it was not Japanese encephalitis virus. It was a new virus related to the Hendra virus from Australia, but distinct, and that it had the capacity to amplify in pigs. So it was infecting pigs all over pig farms in northern Malaysia, and then the people who took care of those pigs, who butchered those pigs, who sold the pork, were the ones who were getting infected, and that was mostly ethnic Chinese people. And then further disease detection traced the virus from the pigs to the bats that had been roosting in fruit trees above the piggeries, the pigsties in these big pig operations. And again, it was because habitat had been destroyed in northern Malaysia. The bats went looking for fruit. They found that the piggery operations were growing fruit as a byproduct. Some of those mango trees and star fruit trees were planted in the vicinity of the piggeries, even overhanging, shading the piggeries. So the bats would go in for the fruit. They would drop their feces and their urine, and they would drop their Nipah virus into the pig corrals. And pigs would pick it up. Pigs got sick. People got sick. Virus spread. Mm-hmm. Another zoonosis.
Well, David, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, where do you think the next spillover zoonosis might occur?
Well, it's precarious to predict, even for a scientist, and I'm not a scientist, I'm just a person who follows scientists and listens to scientists. But what the scientists that I listen to and respect are saying now is something that probably won't surprise anybody, and that is avian influenza is the slot on the roulette wheel where the ball of fate is most likely to land next. That's not to say it's a sure thing. Mm-hmm. There's a great deal of randomness in all of these things. But if you had to bet, the sensible, sobering bet would be on avian influenza. It's been this H5N1 and the variants of H5, high pathogenicity avian influenza. It has been spreading and killing wild birds all over the planet for a number of years now, and getting into domestic poultry operations and killing birds and causing a need for millions of birds to be culled, and then spilling over also into mammals, infecting a certain number of mink and even porpoises and sea lions, and most recently cows in Texas. It has been infected cats. It has been spreading into mammals and occasionally from other mammals into humans. And it is not yet capable of human-to-human spread with any proficiency. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I'm going to knock wood right as I say that. But if that virus underwent a few random mutations that happened to be just the wrong mutations from our point of view, that virus could acquire the capacity to spread readily, not just from one bird to another, but from one mammal to another, and not just maybe from one mink to another and one sea lion to another, but from one human to another. And if that happened, we could have another devastating pandemic on our hands.
Very sobering thought. David, what are you currently working on?
Well, I'm working on another book that's going to sound maybe a little bit sobering and gruesome, but scientifically fascinating to me and I hope important to people. Uh-huh. It's a book on cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon, The evolutionary biology of cancer, which is a field of thought that is in the minority among professional clinical oncologists, but there is a large school of scientists, researchers. Some of them are medical researchers, some of them are evolutionary biologists studying the evolutionary aspects of cancer, and that's what I'm writing about. And I don't want to say much more than that, because I want to write the book before I talk about it.
Okay. Well, of course, we'll look forward to having you back when the book is finished and published. Look forward to having you back to discuss it here on the San Francisco Experience. And David, how can our listeners follow you?
Well, I'm easy to find online. I have a website that's simply www.davidquammen.com. My books are available from your local independent bookstore, I hope, and from all the big operations online. My journalism is out there available, much of it on the web also, and as are my books. I welcome any new readers who might be curious about these strange, tangled, but fascinating things we've been talking about, Jim.
And for the benefit of our listeners, the spelling of David's last name is Quammen, Quammen. Well, David, what about an X handle?
Oh, at David Quammen.
Oh, well, that's easy enough.
Easy. Yep.
And LinkedIn, Facebook, do you use any of them?
I don't, no.
Okay, very good. Well, David, this has been a fascinating conversation today. You've shed light on a lot of questions that I had. I'm sure our listeners had too. And once again, David Quammen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim. Great pleasure talking with you. Interesting conversation, at least for me. I hope for you, and I hope for your readers, for your listeners as well.
Most definitely. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 510. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and join our listener audience in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.